Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. To mark the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, University of Washington professor Robin McCabe planned a series she calls Music from the War to End All Wars. This debut event includes Professor Robert Stacey's talk, A Gathering Storm, Artistic Crisis and the Coming of the First World War. Stacey is a professor of history and UW's dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. As part of the series, UW School of Music students perform a program that includes period pieces composed by Debussy, Defaya, and Bartok. Their combined approach, inspired by music and art, serves as a poignant reflection on the tragic history of the so-called Great War. The University of Washington presented this talk and concert at the Breishman Auditorium on Sunday, December 7th, 2014. Thanks to Gary Louie for this recording. Here, Professor Robin McCabe introduces Professor Robert Stacey.
That's nice to applaud. I haven't done a thing yet. Usually people applaud after I do something. But welcome. I'm delighted to have you here. This is the third theme series that we've been producing at the School of Music, and I'll tell you more about the pleasures of that soon. But I promised our dean a mercifully brief introduction, although there's a lot of wonderful things I could say about him. But I'm particularly pleased that he accepted our invitation to speak today. He comes not as a dean today. He comes as an historian, a person who explores the past and draws inferences from that exploration that hopefully inform the present and perhaps even steer the future. So please join me in the honor of welcoming Bob Stacey.
Thank you very much. I'm really very flattered to be here. My title this afternoon is A Gathering Storm. Artistic Crisis and the Coming of the First World War. It has become conventional amongst historians of almost every stripe to begin the history of 19th century Europe with the French Revolution in 1789 and to end it with the onset of the First World War in 1914, a period often referred to as the long 19th century. I have no quarrel with this periodization, quite the contrary, it seems to me to make eminent good sense. Granted, this long 19th century does leave us by necessity with a very short 20th century. The 20th century doesn't even arrive at the party until 1914, and then, like a rude party guest, it leaves early in 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall. But the 20th century compressed so much horror into its 75 years that I think none of us will wish that it could have lasted any longer than it did. Many of us, I suspect, would just as soon have skipped it altogether. The 19th century, however, is a different matter. Especially in the realms of culture, of literature, music, and painting, it is difficult to think of a century more eventful, more successful, or more productive of great art than the period between 1789 and 1914. Even today, the 19th century remains, for most devotees of high European culture, a kind of golden age, when giants roamed the earth with names such as Beethoven, Brahms, Wordsworth, Goethe, Turner, and Monet, leaving a legacy of unparalleled creative achievement behind them. Whether this is a true estimation of the 19th century's artistic achievements, I leave to others to judge. My taste is mostly in my mouth, and even there, I make no great claims for it. But I can say with some confidence that this is not the way the 19th century saw itself. From the 1850s on, there was a developing sense of crisis right across the arts, a sense among artists, intellectuals, and critics, and this was the first age of criticism, that a tired, staid, worn out, and decidedly uninspiring artistic world was collapsing, and that something radically new and different would be required in the new 20th century to which so many artists were already looking forward. For a great many artists after 1850, the question was only how best to bring this new world into being. Fundamentally, what was at stake in this sense of crisis was the future of Romanticism, the great intellectual movement of late 18th and early 19th century Europe. On some level, the question that faced European artists after 1850 was a simple one. Did Romanticism have a future? And if it did have a future, should it? There was no consensus as to the answer to either question. Instead, there was a cacophony of conflicting voices and views, all firmly held, forcefully argued, and utterly incompatible with one another. Needless to say, such confusion did not lessen the sense of artistic crisis with which the century ended. Indeed, it exacerbated it. To appreciate the contradictory nature of these late 19th century responses to Romanticism, we need to begin with the contradictions of Romanticism itself. Every definition of Romanticism is arguable, but I think there is general agreement that across the arts, the movement was characterized by some common tenets. Amongst these tenets were the following. First, the exaltation of emotion over form. It was not that Romantic art lacked formal elements. It didn't. Indeed, the formal elements of early Romanticism would come to be seen as straitjackets by the later Romantics. But there was a conviction that great art must be driven by strong, clear, pure emotions, and that if these emotions were sincerely and deeply felt, they would determine the literary or musical form of the resulting composition. Novelty was thus a proof of artistic sincerity. To see the oddity of this, compare Ezra Pound's famous remark, so characteristic of 20th century modernism, quote, "I believe in technique as the test of a man's sincerity." Second, the singleness of emotion. Romantic psychology was exceptionally straightforward. Heroes acted heroically. Love was good, and good things could not be destructive. Third, art took an objective subject matter, frequently drawn from nature, but portrayed it subjectively as the individual artist perceived it. Or else, it took an unreal subject matter and made it seem real. Either way, the boundary between object and subject, between the world and the artistic imagination, was occluded and potentially effaced. Both approaches, of course, made for dangerous politics, as the 20th century would discover to its cost. Fourth, art is serious. It is not witty or ironic or common. In the words of Matthew Arnold, poetry, which Arnold thought to be the greatest of the arts, was, quote, "high seriousness written from the soul." Poetry, therefore, required elevated, dignified language with formal, lofty diction. Its rhythms should be simple and stately. In English, this meant iambic pentameter. Pound again, quote, "We've got to end the English propensity for a healthy swat on alternate syllables." And fifth and finally, great art must be driven by a great idea. Matthew Arnold again. It must have a moral lesson to teach. The nobler the art, the nobler the lesson. And the nobler the lesson, the greater the art. By mid-century, however, cracks in this edifice were beginning to show. And by 1900, the building itself had crumbled. Writing many years later in the introduction to the Oxford Book of Modern Verse, William Butler Yeats wrote, quote, "In 1900, everybody got down off his stilts. Henceforth, nobody drank absinthe with his black coffee. Nobody went mad. Nobody committed suicide. Nobody joined the Catholic Church. Or if they did, I have forgotten. Victorianism had been defeated." End quote. But Victorianism, as Yeats used the term, was not quite the same thing as Romanticism. Victorianism, for Yeats, was a kind of complacent bourgeois conformity to a stifling middle-brow literary and artistic culture that reeked of vapid Christian pieties and comfortable virtues. Victorianism was what had made English literature the laughingstock of Europe, as James Joyce declared it to be in 1910. It was also the reason T.S. Eliot, another early 20th century modernist, could remember not a single poet in the generation previous to his own who had influenced him. Instead, Eliot found his models in the metaphysical poets of 17th century England and in the romantic poets of late 19th century France. James Joyce, of course, went back even farther to find his literary models in Homer and Virgil and Dante. Victorianism had to be overthrown. On this, the entire avant-garde of later 19th century Europe was agreed. But as we will see, it was Romanticism itself that provided the tools by which to demolish the Victorian constructions that Romanticism had helped to erect. The attack on Victorianism came from many directions. The search for the impossibly pure emotion, intensely felt, led to a new appreciation for the complexity of human psychology. As the reality of mixed emotions and the destructive power of erotic love became a subject of poetic fascination. The towering figure in this development was Sigmund Freud, whose first book, The Interpretation of Dreams, appeared in 1899. But in fact, French psychologists had been fishing in these intellectual waters for several decades already. And so, too, of course, had Catullus and the metaphysical poets, as well as Verlaine, Mallarmé, and Swinburne. The claim that art should be judged by the nobility of the ideas it expressed came to be seen after 1850 as an assault on the independence of art itself. Art for art's sake became the new battle cry. And Baudelaire decried what he called the heresy of didacticism in art. The essentially representational quality of art was rarely questioned. That attack would come in the next century. But the assault on ideas in art was unrelenting. In the quest to make art an exercise in pure perception, some authors and composers sought to bypass ideation altogether. For Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who was both a painter and a poet, the ultimate poetic achievement would be for poetry to be indistinguishable from painting, so that words could be apprehended directly by the senses without needing to pass through any process of intellectual interpretation. Yeats, too, began his career as a painter and sought, in his pre-1914 poetry, to capture an emotional expressionism that transcended, some would say ignored, the plain sense meaning of his words. To Yeats, this mattered little. Poetry was all about the mood. More often, however, the search for a purely emotional and perceptual art pointed toward music as the supreme artistic form of late Romanticism. Claude Debussy, for example, sought to merge music with both painting and poetry. And I quote here Alex Ross. Although he was later labeled a musical impressionist, Renoir and Monet affected him little. Rather, he was influenced more by Anglo-American painters, such as Turner and Whistler, end quote. But Debussy also sought to integrate music and poetry, composing a cantata based on Rossetti's Blessed Damozel and setting the poems of Verlaine and Baudelaire to music. Schoenberg, too, was deeply influenced by contemporary poetry, and he, too, saw music through a late romantic lens, declaring in a letter to Ferruccio Busoni, quote, I strive for complete liberation from all forms, from all symbols of cohesion and logic. Music should be an expression of feeling, as our feelings, which bring us in contact with our subconscious, really are, and no false child of feelings and conscious logic. End quote. In characteristically epigrammatic mode, Oscar Wilde went even farther. Rejecting altogether the representational nature of art, whether literary or musical, he declared, quote, "Art never expresses anything but itself." The ironies here will be obvious. In its revolt against Romanticism, late 19th century aestheticism, as this movement was called, revealed itself to be an extreme form of Romanticism itself. Aestheticism exalted subjective perception and pure emotion to extreme degrees, even as it rebelled against the formal and intellectual conventions that had characterized earlier 19th century literature and music. For critics of Victorian High Romanticism, there were two potential paths through the artistic detritus that in their minds littered the late 19th century landscape. They could push Romanticism even farther, as did aestheticism, or they could clear the ground by destroying the prevailing cultural norms altogether so that new artistic shoots, when they did begin to emerge, could do so without resistance. But despite bold proclamations to the contrary, and notwithstanding the pleasure that many late 19th century artists took in offending middle-class morals and mores, épater la bourgeoisie, shock and offend the bourgeoisie, was another favorite slogan of the artistic avant-garde. In fact, the road to a new art, for the most part, passed through Romanticism rather than around it. To put the same point in a different way, it was as if all the potentialities of Romanticism had first to be exhausted before something fundamentally new would be possible. Nonetheless, there was plenty of shock value left in Romanticism, even in its old age. Perhaps surprisingly, or perhaps not, some of the biggest changes late Romanticism effected in European self-understanding had to do with the way Europeans understood their own history. By the 1850s, right across Europe, neo-medievalism had become a prominent feature of the cultural landscape. Examples of this attitude can be seen nearly everywhere, in the neo-Gothic revival churches of Pugin, in London, in the Houses of Parliament, rebuilt in Gothic style after a fire in 1834 destroyed the original buildings, in Viollet-le-Duc's reconstruction of Carcassonne, in the aristocratic German enthusiasm for castle building, in the novels of Sir Walter Scott, the histories of Jules Michelet, and in collections of folk songs and traditional ballads, which were believed to offer insight into the pure, unchanging soul of a people and a nation. For the most part, late Romantics, too, embraced medievalism avidly. Characteristic examples would include Tennyson's Lady of Shalott and Idylls of the King, the Pre-Raphaelite painters, William Morris and the Arts and Crafts movement, Dvorak and Manuel de Falla, who sought to make new music from old traditions of popular song, and of course, towering over everyone else, Wagner, whose work illustrates the way in which the primitivism of the Middle Ages could be seen as foundational to a very modern and potentially quite dangerous kind of nationalism, that in Wagner's case drew upon an imagined pre-Christian German past to define what it might now mean to be a subject in a newly united Germany. But not only in Germany was modern nationalism being dressed in medieval garb. Especially after France's crushing defeat in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, right-wing French politicians and pundits turned powerfully toward a vision of la France profonde, whose nature was inherently rural, inward, and bellicose, in the words of Frederick Brown. The symbol of this old, new France became Joan of Arc, the peasant girl who led French resistance against an English conquest of France during the 15th century. In the 18th century, Voltaire had mocked Joan as a naive young woman of easy virtue and uncertain purpose. In the late 19th century, no such irreverence was tolerated. In 1904, when a history teacher at the Lycée Condorcet had the impertinence, quote, to cast doubt on the role of divine intercession in Joan's triumph at the Battle of Orléans. And keep in mind, this was in 1429. And then proposed to analyze the English invasion of France in its 15th century context, rather than to portray the English as an expression of transcendent evil. This provoked demonstrations, parliamentary outrage, a duel, a press campaign, and finally a public reprimand and a savage beating of the misguided teacher by a band of right-wing thugs. The teacher was finally transferred to a less visible school. As Frederick Brown remarks, in France, quote, quote, the cult of a virgin savior, indeed, the neo-romantic penchant in conservative circles for all things medieval, reflected a fortress France nationalism, whose mission was not only to protect the fatherland from external hordes, but to defend the cohesive social organism against subversive change. Medievalism did have its critics, however. Not everyone in the 19th century saw themselves happily clad in a suit of armor. The assault on 19th century medievalism began in Switzerland with a German-speaking reactionary figure named Jakob Burckhardt, who hated almost everything about the 19th century, but who especially despised democracy, the Catholic Church, and the working class. Burckhardt was a cultural historian, strongly influenced by Hegel's philosophy of history, with its emphasis upon spirit as the animating force behind historical periodization. Burckhardt hated his own age, and so hated equally the Middle Ages with which his contemporaries so strongly identified. In good Hegelian fashion, he therefore admired whatever historical period was the antithesis of the benighted, priest-besotted Middle Ages. And so he invented the Renaissance and found in it the opposite of almost everything he hated about his own day. If the Middle Ages were an age of faith, then the Renaissance was secular. If the Middle Ages emphasized communal identities, then the Renaissance was all about individualism. And if the Middle Ages were characterized by weak central governments and feeble kingship, then the Renaissance was an era of despots and dictators, of whom Burckhardt heartily approved. Burckhardt's discovery of the Renaissance was quickly taken up by a group of dissident English writers and critics, including Arthur Symons, Algernon Swinburne, and Walter Pater, who added to Burckhardt's view of the Renaissance a final crucial ingredient. Smothered by the conformity of bourgeois Victorianism, and searching for a world in which avant-garde artists and intellectuals would become the leaders of a revolutionary new cultural movement, they too found the historical models they sought in the Renaissance, and especially in Renaissance art. And so the myth of the Renaissance as an historical period that marked the end of the Middle Ages and the birth of the modern, secular, individualistic, scientific, and artistic world was born. Whether such a world ever existed in 15th and 16th century Italy is extremely doubtful. But it did exist in late 19th century Europe, and that is where we should properly seek to find it. Aside from the Middle Ages, the other historical mirror in which mid-19th century Europe saw itself reflected was a Roman one. This, of course, was not a new idea. It's no accident that the late 18th century American Constitution established a government that included a Senate, or that the Senate met in a Capitol building named after the Capitoline Hills in ancient Rome. Nor is it accidental that so many late 19th century banks in both Europe and America were built to look like Roman temples. Roman imperialism went down well in a 19th century European world, devoted to imperialism abroad, as the inevitable and beneficent consequence of the superiority of European civilization. And so, just as Rome had once brought that civilization to the benighted pagans of Western Europe, so now would Western Europe do to the benighted denizens of Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. It was all part of what Kipling would call the white man's burden. So ubiquitous and flattering was this Roman mirror, however, that in their drive to tear down Victorianism, even the most vehement late 19th century critics could not entirely throw off their togas. But instead of seeing themselves as citizens of the Roman Empire at its height, they chose instead to cast themselves as the representatives of Rome in its decadence and decline, affecting a romantically inflected languor. Vier Deleuil Adam and Axel remarking, quote, "As for living, our servants will do that for us," and devoting themselves to the most extraordinary theosophical and mystical nonsense. But this sense of a world in decline could also take on a more sinister edge. Oswald Spengler's Jeremiad, Das Untergang des Abendlandes, translated into English as the decline of the West, but it loses its punch in English, became a bestseller. Social Darwinism came to be seen by many as the only way to reverse a creeping degeneracy evident in the poverty of the working class. There was also a nasty racial element in this widespread notion of late 19th century degeneracy. Schoenberg applied this notion of degeneracy to music, augmenting his attack on contemporary tonality with the vocabulary of social Darwinism and racial theory. While the president of the American Historical Association explained the decline and fall of the Roman Empire as the result of what he called race mixing. When decadent Orientals, by whom he seems to have meant Greeks, interbred with and weakened the pure racial stock of Rome. The lesson was not lost on the white rulers of late 19th century empires who lorded it over millions of black and brown colonial subjects at home and abroad. More encouragingly, however, it was out of this same sense of themselves as participants in a declining empire that some of the most interesting new literary and musical work of the pre-war period would emerge. If the center cannot hold, as Yeats famously wrote in his poem The Second Coming, then perhaps the cultural periphery of Europe would be where European art would be reborn. In Ireland, the Gaelic revival was a self-consciously anti-colonial reaction, which saw itself as reinvigorating both Irish and European culture through the rediscovery of authentic national traditions in an historically marginal area. Something similar was also taking place in music. Janáček, Bartók, Defia, and even Ravel, who, although French, was born in the Basque Country and never shook the feeling that he had come from somewhere else. All can be plausibly seen in this context. So too can Picasso and Miró, both of whom were Catalans. The search led in some strange directions, but it was enormously productive for the arts as a whole. And so we arrive at the dawn of the new century. By 1900, the sense that the age had gone dead and that no great art was possible in this time was widespread. Romanticism had run its course, and although it would have one final flowering in the surrealist movement of the 1920s, its creative possibilities had been exhausted. Victorianism was dead, but as yet there was nothing that could take its place. What was needed, many people believed, was a resurrection, the kind of resurrection that could come only as a consequence of cataclysmic death and destruction. This is late Romanticism, and artists and intellectuals bought into such ideas heavily. The futurist Filippo Marinetti wrote in 1909, quote, "No longer is there beauty except in battle. Everything that deserves the title of masterpiece has an aggressive character." Even so refined and pacific a man as Thomas Mann could write in November 1914, "War! We felt purified, liberated. We felt an enormous hope." Mann was not alone in this reaction. In the words of Alex Ross, quote, "Many artists were exhilarated when the Great War began. It was as if their gaudiest fantasies of violence and destruction had come to life. Schoenberg, in particular, fell into the grip of what he would later call his war psychosis, drawing comparisons between the German army's assault on decadent France and his own assault on decadent bourgeois values. In a letter to Alma Mahler, dated August 1914, Schoenberg waxed militant in his zeal for the German cause, denouncing in the same breath the music of Bizet, Stravinsky, and Ravel. "Now comes the reckoning," Schoenberg thundered. "Now we will throw these mediocre kitschmongers into slavery and teach them to venerate the German spirit and to worship the German God." End quote. Rudyard Kipling, the poet laureate of empire, was no less enthusiastic on the English side about the beneficial consequences of war. Nor was his enthusiasm for war limited to literature. When his only son, John, volunteered for war in 1915, John was only 17. His father happily signed the necessary permission papers to allow his underage son to enlist. Needless to say, the consequences of the Great War did not live up to anyone's hopes. John Kipling disappeared in the Battle of Loos, an indecisive battle in a war of indecisive battles, less than a month after he reached the front. His parents spent years searching for him. His body was never found, and it was not until 1917 that the Kiplings gave up hope that he might be found alive. A sense of personal responsibility for the death of his son tormented Kipling, who saw clearly his own responsibility and that of his contemporaries for forming an entire generation's ideas about the character-forming manliness and nobility of combat. Years later, in his epitaph of war, Kipling was still trying to come to grips with his son's death and the death of millions of other sons just like him. In his poem Common Form, Kipling reached a simple but devastating conclusion. Speaking in the voice of a soldier, he wrote, quote, "If any question why we died, tell them, because our fathers lied." I end on this note of anger and pathos because it seems to me that's what war is. I've tried to paint this afternoon a picture of the artistic world that preceded the First World War in Europe, and that to some unknowable degree prepared the ground for it. Did artists and intellectuals cause the war? Certainly not. But they cannot evade responsibility for the war any more than can the rest of their fellow citizens and subjects. And in the new century that dawned in 1914, and for which they had so ardently hoped, artists and intellectuals would have to come to grips with the unimagined consequences of their romantic dreams. Thank you.
I knew that would be wonderful, and it was. What a great inauguration of reflection for us to begin this exploration together. I have to tell you that one of the great pleasures of organizing these theme concerts is the interactions that I have with the students and the faculty, and their eagerness to get involved. It's really been a wonderful voyage. Now this is our third, and I'm especially looking forward to this as we explore the nuances of creativity that surround these composers in the time of the war. As Bob alluded to, I think this was a war of absurd irony. And I'll start by painting the picture of 1913, the year before the war. It was a year of matchless artistic achievement. Proust kicked off Remembrance of Things Past. The Cubists kicked back. Stravinsky kicked out with The Rite of Spring. Everything was really boundlessly optimistic. There was energy rumbling around the continent. And then, of course, we all know what happened. Stefan Zweig describes the summer of 14 before the war as the most beautiful that Europe had experienced for years. Gorgeous weather, everyone at the beaches. And then, of course, the Archduke and his consort are shot. The troop trains start running. And this culture of optimism and buoyancy is catapulted into mass suicide, and 10 million Europeans and the death of a civilization. Absurdly ironic. Zweig tells us, frankly, that nobody really liked the Archduke very much anyway. He was a doer, bewhiskered, portly man, and Zweig describes him night after night at the Vienna Opera, sitting there watching these wonderful performers and musicians with not even the littlest smile on his face. Vienna didn't mourn for very long, ironically. Of course, they were all waiting for Rudolf, the heir apparent, and of course we know how badly that ended up later. But let me tell you a little tale of one of the absurdities. Because the world was unprepared for anything of this scale, it had never known a war of this scale, there were all kinds of things that happened. And in England, in 1915, the British public, the British military, suddenly found itself disastrously short of precision optical instruments, telescopes, reconnaissance cameras, above all, binoculars. A call went out to the British public, please, send us your binoculars. They got 2,000 pairs, including four each from the King and the Queen. They were disastrously short. And the factories of England were not capable of producing these precision instruments. So quietly, the Minister of Munitions dispatched an envoy to neutral Switzerland to deal with the country that did have great experience in this, the firm of Zeiss in Germany. And the Germans showed themselves all too willing to enter into this contract with the British. Yes, we will deliver you binoculars. We'd even say, take a look at the prisoners you've taken so far, their equipment, and you can give us examples of what which kind you would like to have. So this quiet contract, some 400,000 pairs of binoculars, infantry and artillery, were delivered to the British so that they could better, in their sights, look at German infantry officers and shoot them. This was done quietly, but the records are there. Now, what did the Germans want in return? Another precious commodity, without which they couldn't have telephone wires or wheels on the car, rubber. And the British blockade, the British Royal Navy had completely blockaded Germany. But, of course, the Allies had lots of rubber in Asian and African countries, and so a deal was brokered. Now, to this day, we don't know exactly how much rubber the documents have been lost, but here's the interesting thing. What was at the heart of this? Did either party think they were getting the better deal? Or was it a bunch of businessmen that looked for profit? Or perhaps most alarming of all was the idea, fight this war well and good, no matter even if it means trading with the enemy. An amazing irony. There are other ironies we'll explore, but this one really, really captured my imagination. Dennis is going to come out here and play some Spanish music. Actually, the whole theme of this first half is folk music, folk song. And I've been in thinking about this afternoon, I was thinking there is an impulse, I think, that is awakened by war and nationalism to turn to the roots of a culture, to look back. You're going to see that in Faya and Bartok. The first composer he'll be playing is Miguel Lobe, who's not well known, but he probably was the guitar virtuoso, Spanish guitar virtuoso of the 19th century. Toured Europe, toured America several times, actually made a very early wax recording at Bell Labs in New Jersey. He wasn't happy with the recording, but he was at least experimenting. Wrote many, many wonderful Catalan folk songs, two of which you're going to hear. Lobe was also the teacher of Segovia, was probably one of the most... Now, Segovia, in his memoirs, says he didn't really learn a lot from Lobe, which, of course, as a teacher now, really, when I always read something like that, I think, you ungrateful wretch, you probably learned a lot more than... But at any rate, he was a wonderful, wonderful composer. You're going to hear that. And then, so Dennis will be doing two songs, La Nita Nadal, the Christmas Eve, and La Filadora, the Spinner Woman. And then he's turning to Faya, a composer you'll hear a little bit more of after Dennis. What can I tell you? The Miller's Dance that he's going to play is from Faya's famous ballet, The Three-Cornered Hat. And it's a pantomime ballet, but generally the hero is the miller and his faithful wife. The wife is being pursued very amorously by the town magistrate. And so the ballet is basically about this triangle, and everything comes to a very nice end. The magistrate is sort of tossed out on his ear, and the faithful marriage endures. So please help me welcome Dennis Ha. Thank you.
Thank you.
That last piece is a wonderful piece. I confess that I tried to make an arrangement for it for piano, and it just doesn't cut it. like that guitar. You really need that wonderful atmosphere. We're going to continue with Defia, a wonderful song cycle, seven popular songs. I printed some translations, so if you didn't get your own copy, sit close and nice and cuddle up to somebody else who does have them, because it is nice to see the English translation. These were so successful that they have ended up being transcribed for various medium. I do want to bring to light one element of Defia's wonderful music to you. It's related to flamenco, of course. He spent much time promoting this kind of what was called cante hondo, the deep song. And you'll hear these qualities imbued in this music to come. It's a very intimate expression, not unlike fado in Portugal. But even in some of Faya's piano music, he tries to imitate the human voice with guitar. And again, this is a lament, usually a very serious kind of poetic. So I'm going to play you a snippet from Faya's Fantasia Beatica, which is the piano imitating the wailing, keening of cante hondo. Comes from Andalusia, and Faya became so keen on promoting this thing that actually with the poet Garcia Lorca, they founded a Cante Hondo society and had festivals and concerts promoting this kind of wonderful, a cross between chant and keening and moaning. And Faya writes to himself that the songs that you're going to hear, more important than the letter or the notes are the spirit, the incredible expressivity and the freedom of the singer to undulate, to bend the pitches a little bit. I think you're going to enjoy this performance very much. Please welcome Jane and Dakota.
Thank you.
I will partly blame myself for not gently, with a velvet tongue, to remind you to turn off your cell phones. It's just so easy, it can happen. As a matter of fact, many of you might know the story. Some years ago, the famous cellist Glenn Harrell came out to play the Dvorak Cello Concerto with the Seattle Symphony downtown. And in the middle of the elegiac slow movement, Lynn's own cell phone went off in his tuxedo pocket and halted the entire slow movement. And I think probably he couldn't have been more horrified. He'd forgotten to leave the phone in his dressing room, and here he is in the middle of his own solo piece. So it can happen. And again, it's partly my responsibility to remind you we're all so tied to these phones. I always tease my students, you're afraid to be alone with your own thoughts anymore, aren't you? And they kind of look like, yeah, maybe I really am. And you know, that one of my pet peeves is some of the greatest music composed in our universe was from people who walked in the countryside, Schubert, Beethoven, and they listened to the sounds of nature. They did not have a bud in their ear. But I digress. So, to get our students to unclick, you know, it's a real challenge. We're turning now to Béla Bartók, who was also extremely upset at the outbreak of the war. He wrote to a friend, "I'm completely paralyzed. I cannot work." He tried to enlist, but he was very frail. They turned him down, and he also wrote a letter. He said, "I guess they took one look at me and knew I couldn't carry a pack." He was not wrong about that. In 1912, he wrote to a friend, I'm officially celebrating 1 year to the death of myself as a composer. Now, he wrote that because he'd had terrible trouble. His music was received badly by the critics, and he was thoroughly despondent. And he writes, I'm going to turn myself now almost exclusively to my folk music research. And that kind of inaugurated a period of great fertility in that area. Now, he was traveling all over Europe, collecting gramophone little snippets of recordings of different folk songs in the Balkans, Romania, and he really wanted to do more traveling. He made it to Africa, North Africa, in 1913, just before the war broke out. But the war pretty much benched him back home. But because of that trip to North Africa, you often hear in Bartok wonderful little snippets of Arabian kind of music. And I want to give you a very brief example because it will illustrate some of the qualities you're going to hear in the Peasant Suite. This is from one of his little Romanian dances. It couldn't be any more evocative, I think, of that corner of the world. You hear these qualities creep in, even the orchestral music. So, I mean, he was really a dedicated folklorist. And on that note, before you hear this performance, I have a fascinating bit of history for you all, which hits very close to home, this very school of music. The year is 1941. The war has not yet broken out, that other war. And Bartok is in America. He's currently at Columbia University with a 2-year appointment as a composer and researcher, and he's beginning to correspond with the director of this very school of music at the University of Washington, a man by the name of Carl Page Wood. And to Dr. Wood's credit and his discernment, he's trying to bring Bartok here as a Walker Ames Fellow. And all of you at the university know the vestiges of the Walker Ames professorship today helps us bring fantastic scholars and artists to this campus. We even have a hall named for the Walker Ames, where you hear the pipe organ, among other things. And so this is this charming little letter, which I have a scan of in credit to our music librarian. He writes to the director, Dear Professor Wood, I want only to tell you that I will arrive in Seattle on November 28 at 5:30 p.m. This is written from Palo Alto. Perhaps the next morning we could have that discussion mostly about technicalities. I should like to know and see what gramophones there are, and do you have a copy machine? What material with Indian folk music do you have, and if, how these texts are already transcribed? Yours very sincerely, Bela Bartok. P.S. I got an invitation from Mrs. Beck, and I will stay in her house. Don't know who Mrs. Beck is, but so it's interesting that the university is trying to bring Bartok. Now, it was not successful. I have a feeling it was partly because when the war started in December, all hell broke loose, and he had not finished his appointment at Columbia, so there was some red tape involved. But to the credit of the university here, they weren't bringing him here only as a teacher. They wanted him to have a research appointment where he can do research about these anthropological things. Indeed, he did meet with a professor in anthropology here. So we have a little liaison to Bartok, which I think is something kind of touching and wonderful. Now, also, if we had succeeded in bringing him by 1942, he was not well. He died of leukemia in 1945 in New York. So his health was waning, but he certainly was interested in coming here. So now you're going to hear a wonderful piece for flute and piano, again, very evocative of the folk. I would even say this music is more declamatory. You're going to hear the flute and the piano actually talking back and forth in conversation. There are also very exotic harmonies in this piece, somewhat modal. There's also, towards the end, you'll hear a drone in the piano, kind of a cross between a bagpipe, perhaps a jew's harp, but again, very evocative of this kind of color that he's bringing. So help me welcome Natalie and Li Chen.
Thank you.
The reason I played that snippet for you is I want you to know that's not the kind of Debussy you're going to hear now. This was Debussy in his early years. It doesn't make it any less good. It was wonderful and is wonderful, but it's not emblematic of the composer that he develops into. So what you're going to hear now, both these works in the last half are very late Debussy, during the war, and Debussy was profoundly affected by this war. We'll talk about that a little bit before the sonata. But first you're going to hear a remarkable piece for solo flute, and Professor Shin can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it hadn't been since Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach in very 150 years before that there was a piece for solo flute, standalone solo flute. And this has become a staple. This is the bread and butter of every good flutist repertoire because it is a remarkable and a very tiny, short piece. The syrinx was originally called Pan's Flute, and Debussy had composed it to be part of a play by the name of Psyche, I think it was, and it was never finished. So he changed the name because there was another song title of the same thing, the Flute of Pan, so he changed it to Syrinx, which is the myth, the goddess. She's actually a nymph. She's a very beautiful young nymph, Syrinx. And Pan is in love with her. And Pan pursues her amorously and tenaciously, but she resists. And she turns herself into a basket of reeds in the water. And Pan, according to the myth, comes and cuts the reeds, thereby killing Syrinx. So again, this is late Debussy. It's a beautiful use of the instrument, actually exploits the textures and colors. It's very undulant. It's not very tonal. You're not going to know where home is some of the part, but that's part of the beauty. It's also written with a great deal of latitude given to the performer. So if you compare various flute performances, Paula Robeson, Marcel Moise, Jeannie Backstresser, they all come in on YouTube at a little bit different times, 3 minutes 10, 2 minutes 50, and that's because they're taking freedom to improvise and take space in the music. So it's almost like an improvisation. It's the notes and pitches are written out, but what you do with them, what you bend, how you bend them and color them, is very much up to the performer. And this is very forward-looking music. You're going to hear, kind of looks forward to the 20th century. So here is Mona playing syrinx for solo flute.
Thank you.
know, I have to give a nod of appreciation to this kind of playing, because we pianists, you know, one of the things is it's so easy for us to make the sounds. We just put our fingers down. But to have to produce that sound at each pitch and to listen, so I often am quite in admiration. I can imagine, you know, having listened to my niece begin then the violin, that there are some rather unpleasant months when a person starts these kinds of instruments. But with the piano, there's instant gratification, of course. Just put the finger down and we can produce a sound. So when you think about the production of an instrument so close to your body and the acute conscience that you have to develop to produce those sounds. Indeed, I'm always complaining to my piano students, you don't have a conscience. You're not thinking about the sound you produce. Oh, really? Yeah, that's right. So I always think that's one of the problems. It's too easy to make a sound on this, so we don't develop the acuity and, in a sense, the moral responsibility for the kind of sound we make. So fascinating dilemma. Now, if we turn to this final piece on the program, and before we do, I want to thank you sincerely for coming, honoring us with your presence. I urge you to come to the March concert and the May concert. There's wonderful repertoire awaiting you and some provocative presentations by two of our scholars in the university, just as you heard from the dean today. And maybe we'll even be able to add a few compositions to the menu that's to come. But again, thank you for, look, I haven't heard the Seahawks score because I promised I wouldn't turn on my earbud. Does anyone have a final score? Excellent, yay. I promised I wouldn't put the bud in my ear after the lecture that I gave you. Anyway, as I had said before, the outbreak of the war really affected Debussy. First of all, he was quite ill. But he had smelled the war coming for some time. And as the dean was talking about Schoenberg's glorification of Germany, well, Debussy probably is the polar antithesis of this. If there was anything anti-German, that was Claude Debussy. He hated the Germans, and he hated Wagner. And you know, he played a cruel joke on Wagner in a little piano piece called The Gollywog's Cakewalk, which many of you might have played. And I played it as a kid, and I didn't know that basically Debussy was thumbing his nose at Wagner in the middle of it with this. And then he has laughter there. So he has this quote in the middle of the Gollywog, and he said, play this with grand emotion. So that's illustration for the performer. So, you know, I was 8 years old and my teacher didn't tell me. I probably wouldn't have appreciated it now, but now I realize what a snide thing it is for Debussy to do. But as I say, he resented Wagner. He resented the German dominance of music, and he was trying to move away from that. You can hear the nationalism creep into these late works. The Marseillaise appears, and there's a wonderful two piano piece called En Blanc et Noir, White and Black, and there are eerie bugle calls in the piano throughout this eerie kind of, and you can almost hear this cold landscape and some poor soldier in a dawn light trying to, you know, call, rise the troops, but it's presented in a very cold way. I have to give you a couple of quotes in his letters where he talks. One is to Stravinsky, one is to he says, quote, I won't get on the subject of German barbarity. It's exceeded all expectations. I think we're going to have to pay dearly, dearly for the right to dislike the music of Richard Strauss and Schoenberg. And as for Beethoven, thank God somebody's discovered he was a Fleming. And in a letter to Stravinsky, Debussy writes, I have felt the Austro-German miasma spreading over art. How could we have not foreseen that these men were plotting the destruction of our art, just as they had planned the destruction of our country? Worst of all is this racial hatred, which will end only with the last of the Germans. Will there ever be a last German? I'm convinced that their soldiers reproduce among themselves. So it was, and Debussy himself had some guilt about not going to fight, but he was much too old and much too ill. This piece you're going to hear is the last piece he wrote for violin and piano, piano and violin. In many ways, it looks back. It's more old-fashioned than the syrinx that you just heard, but in other ways, it's very forward-looking. And he writes about this piece, again, he said, "The sonata, I've at last finished the sonata for violin and piano. It's one of those very human contradictions that, as depressed as I feel, it is full of happiness and uproar. The finale of this piece goes through the most curious contortions before ending up with a simple idea that turns back on itself." Now, the first movement is rather modal. It's quite fascinating, a little bit dark. Amazing use of textures in both the violin and the piano. You're going to hear almost gossamer textures. If you close your eyes, it's almost like the thinnest filament of sound, and yet moments of great power. The second movement is a grotesque but playful scherzo. And the last movement, which I can't remember, maybe Laura can tell you how it's marked, but this last movement is very characteristic of Debussy in his finales. He loved a fast, swirling, kind of pent-up texture. The Gardens in the Rain, the Mouvement from Images, he loved these kinds of very light, quick, swirling, almost dervish-like figures, and I think that you will get that effect. So for the finale of our program, please welcome Laura and Alione in the Debussy Sonata for violin and piano.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for queuing up this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please pay it forward with a good review. It helps more people find us. The University of Washington presented this talk and concert at the Breishman Auditorium on Sunday, December 7th, 2014. Thanks to Gary Louie for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.